Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Wednesday, and I can't forbear to note that this week is the Yahrzeit of Yonatan Abschitz. So even though I'm very hesitant to hit on that one, but, you know, you can't skip the white elephant in the room, as the expression goes. But I'm going to surprise you, because I think I am. I don't know where this is going to go, but everybody's just like last week did the morale, and everybody wants to know about the golem. So when it comes to Yonatan Abschitz, everybody just wants to know about Shabtai Tzvi, because of the Amden Abschitz controversy. But there's so much more involved with this very, very unusual person, Yonatan Abschitz. The great, among the greatest rabbis of the 1700s. And the whole part about the Amden Abschitz controversy is really understood by a very, very few people. Despite a lot of people flatter themselves they know what they're talking about, but they sure don't. So I'm going to try to talk about the man, and like I did last week, the Marab, talk about the person who you probably have no idea about, other than some glittering generalities and a huge amount of Baba Mises. I think more lies told in connection with the Yonatan Abschitz than probably anyone else. Anyway, without any further ado, because I have a limited amount of time as always, and I have to go to school soon, so let me see what I can pack into a few minutes. We're talking over here about Rabbi Yonatan Abschitz, who is one of the big, maybe the biggest rabbi among them, of the first half of the 1700s. Okay, that just to put the time on, and in Central Europe. So it's an Ashkenazi rabbi in Central Europe from, I think he's 1694 to 1764. So, you know, there you go, for the first half of the 1700s. I'm not talking about the second half, I'm talking about the first half. And which is a very unusual period in Jewish history in many respects. And certainly in his case. And I don't think it's well known. Now, Yonatan Abschitz is born, or at least certainly grew up, in Moravia, which is this province that I spoke about. We went on my trip last month or whenever, back in July, when we went to Nikolsburg, which is the capital of Moravia. I've spoken about it a bunch of times. This is an area of about 50 small Jewish communities. There's a nice map of it in Professor Miller's book I like, and of Jewish communities over there. And this is a little different than what you usually come across, because most of the people you heard of learned in Poland, or maybe learned in Germany, you know, places. That's your typical Ashkenazi rabbi of the old school. Maybe learned in Prague, you know, but Moravia, less so. And Moravia, very unusual place. It is true that Moravia was a big headquarters of sympathizers of Shabtai Tzvi. That is a fact. So it's just very, very interesting. He's born in 1694. His father is a Rav. He becomes a Rav of a town in Moravia. The name of this town is Abschitz. Get it? Now you understand. He's Rav Yonatan from Abschitz. That's the name of the city, the town. And, you know, his father was a Talmud Chacham. The key point is that he was obviously somebody who really is a bona fide genius from a young age. But the father died when he was only 14 years old. And the mother had died earlier. So here, just as a human being who loses both parents not long, but by the time's bar mitzvah, a year later. That's just interesting. And he goes to learn in Prosnitz, which is another small community of yesteryear in Moravia, that's right, where this new young Rosh Yeshiva had set up Operation the Punim Iris, who I spoke about with Donald Trump a couple weeks ago, and ended up in Eisenstadt. Punim Iris basically was the big hot yeshiva, and Yonatan Abschitz flourished there, and there's a million stories about him. Most of them are not true, but they're good anyway. My favorite story, like I said before, not that I'm saying it's true, my famous story is they said when he was a kid in the yeshiva, a young kid, so he was elected to be the Purim Rav. What does it mean, Purim Rav, in the old days? You have to give a sheer klali, but it can't be one word of emes in it. That's already tricky. You know, to mix emes and sheker, anybody can do. But to be kulo emes is not so easy. And to be kulo sheker is also not so easy. So how do you give a sheer klali kulo sheker? And the story goes that he said he's going to give a, he gave a speech. You know, was he 12 years old, something like that? Gave a Shir Kloli, armed, clothed in the garb of the poor rabbi, on the following subject. Kol HaMagadol Kelev Ra Bebeso Malo Lavakasu Ki Liyoldo. Now, if you don't know what that means, don't worry. Anyway, but if you do, you'll appreciate it. Now, moving on. So here's somebody who's 14. He's obviously hot stuff in terms of learning. So the Rosh Yeshiva really likes him, naturally. This yeshiva was bankrolled because nobody had a yeshiva in those days, unless there was some sugar daddy behind it, by the richest Jew, Shimshon Wertheimer, who was the court Jew. Now, there's the Austrian, this is the Austrian Empire. So the Austrian emperor, who was pretty anti-Semitic, made exceptions for rich Jews that could help him. And the most famous of these rich Jews who stood in tight with the emperor was Shimshon Wertheimer, who was a Frum guy, very wealthy. And he financed the wars and the battles and all that. And he paid for the yeshiva, the Panim Yeras. In fact, he moved him later on with the yeshiva and everything, the Panim Yeras, to the town of Eisenstadt. And that's where I was, me, myself, and I with my tour group back in July. Made it my business to stop over there. And you can go there now in Eisenstadt, if you choose, and go to the shul and base manners and all that of Shimshon Wertheimer. And, you know, they have all the stuff about him there. Anyway, and the reason I mention it is, so, and by the way, Shimshon Wertheimer was a Talmud Chacham too. You know, it was that kind of court Jew. He wasn't the type that was just rich and unlearned and all that. And naturally, one of the best guy in the yeshiva for his daughter. And the story is that he wanted this young guy who was 16 years old, by this time, the best guy in yeshiva by far, to be his son-in-law, in which case he could have lived the life of Riley. And he turned it down. Instead, remember, he had no parents. If he had parents, they probably would have said, take it. But he made his own decision, and he married a different girl, Elke, from a different family. Don't worry, her family had money too. Not like Wertheimer, but they had plenty of money, and they were big rabbonim, and she was related to everybody. With her, he got the yichus. And the yeshiva world and the rabbinical world, if you ain't married to the right person, you ain't going nowhere. I don't care who you are. So he made his business now that he's not only, of course, on the other hand, if we would have married the billionaire's daughter, he could have written his own ticket. So it's just interesting that in that world of yesteryear, if you were the best guy in yeshiva, you could have quite an interesting future. But he married this girl whose father was a rich rabbi in Bohemia, actually. Now, you probably know what I'm talking about. There's a country called Czechoslovakia. No, there's not. There's a country called Czech. It used to be Czechoslovakia. Now they're two countries. They got divorced from each other back in the 1990s. Now there's a country called the Czech Republic, which is composed of two parts, Bohemia and Moravia. And her father was a rabbi in Bohemia. As a matter of fact, he eventually became the chief rabbi of Ganz Bohemia. There were two chief rabbi positions. They were not identical. One was the chief rabbi of Prague, and the other was the chief rabbi of Bohemia. It's a little confusing. But it means he came from a chashuv and wealthy family, and he was related to everybody. You name me a big rabbi from Central Europe in the early 1700s, and she was related to him. So by marrying her, he married money, but he also married, pull everywhere. You know, related to Avram Brodin, the Shulis Yaakov, and the Chacham Tzvi, and this, and that, and the other. Now, from his father-in-law, he moved in with him, and he spent a year or two learning halacha l'maisa, because his father was a rov. So in yeshiva, you learn pilpul. Especially in those days, the golden age of pilpul, and or maybe it's not a golden age, whatever. From the following, you learn a lachal ma'isa, so he will emerge. I'm talking about Jonas and Abschitz now, as an A+ in the area of halachal ma'isa and also in the area of lumdus. You don't find that too often. Now, when he's 19, he moved to Prague. Then he moved away for a year, but eventually he settles in Prague, like when he's 20 years old, with his wife. Remember, her father and relatives are all big machers in Prague. We've talked about it before. For a guy like him living in small towns in Moravia, to move to Prague is like a guy, I don't know, you know, some small community in America with a kollel somewhere, and then moving to Lakewood, or Muncie, or something like that, you know, or Bnei Brak. Because Prague had like 10,000 Jews, and a bunch of yeshivas, not one, and some really significant Talmidei Chacham, so you're really coming to the headquarters, if you're a Lumdish guy, and he sure was, you're coming to the place where a lot of people to talk to and argue with. As I told you last week and on other occasions when we talked about the, Yontav Lippman Heller, the Tosis Yontav, and the Maral, Prague was always a city of scholarship and strife, machlokes, big time machlokes. And that remained all the way through the 1700s. When he came there, for example, there were two huge fights that were raging in the Prague world where the Prague rabbis against the others, two very famous halachic controversies from yesteryear. I won't go into a length about it, but just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about. They both actually involved the Chacham Tzvi, who was a rabbi in Hamburg, and, you know, there was a lot of fights back and forth. One was what you call the Meinekes Chavero controversy, and the other one is the chicken without the heart case. The first case was that, you know, you're not allowed, a lady's not allowed to get married if her husband dies or anything like that, or get divorced, if she had a baby, if she's nursing for 2 years, the Meinekes Chavero. And in this case, the rabbi in Hamburg, Altona Hamburg, was the Chacham Tzvi, gave her heter, which is controversial. On the other hand, he was a big guy also. And all the rabbis in Prague said it's nusser, and she can't do it, and all hell broke loose, and the whole world was fighting over this. And the second one was the famous case of the chicken without a heart, where a girl said that she brought to base in a case where she has a chicken that didn't have a heart. How could it survive? It survived. I'm simplifying, but that's the bottom line. And again, the Chacham Tzvi said the chicken is kosher. The Gemara says it doesn't have a heart, it's treif. Literally, treifa. So he said, look, it can't not have a heart, right? And the other said, well, it didn't have a heart. And so, I know it sounds a little bit funny to people now, but I can just tell you there were fights over this. And so, for a guy like Yonatan Abishas, a young guy coming in, just married, just got smicha, just this and that and the other, this is great. I mean, he can hock and learning with the best of them. There's plenty to talk about. Now, listen closely. Here's somebody who moves and settles in Prague in 1714. That means he's 20 years old. For the next 30 years, in his 20s, 30s, and 40s, the best years of his life, he lived in Prague. So he's a Prague guy, and if it was up to him, he would stay in Prague his whole life. And before he died, he wanted to retire and move back to Prague. In Prague, he built up a huge following because he wasn't a Rav. He wanted that job, but someone else had it, right? The person who had the job was, Rav David Oppenheim, who was a very big Talmud Chacham, and he's famous for the big library collected. I just took out of my library, the local library, some professor or academic guy just wrote a book on David Oppenheimer. It's called Prince of the Press. It must be his dissertation that he published very recently, all about this is a famous bibliophile, which means it's not a pedophile, a bibliophile. He loves books. He collected a very famous set. But he was a big Talmud Chacham also. You have Shalos and Tshuvos from him, and he was a Rav. And I think it's not, Yonatan Abishas would have wanted that job, and Heldy's more fitting than the Rav. So right off the bat, you can see is going to be parties and machloikis, because who should really have the Av Basin or Chief Rabbi position? On the other hand, thanks to his wife's family and stuff like that, they found sugar daddies that he could have his own yeshiva. As a matter of fact, he even was elected to have the official yeshiva of the community. They were like a bunch. And once he got the position to be the Rashiva of his own yeshiva, then it's all totally charisma, right? In other words, if you can attract the guys, you can attract the guys. Here he was extraordinarily and phenomenally successful. This is a dover. You do it. Nobody can contest this. In these 30 years, in his 20s, his 30s and 40s, he must have been unbelievably charismatic. I don't know who's listening to this right now, but if you've gone through yeshivas and high schools and all that, you either belong to one of two categories. Either you never hooked up with a Rebbe in a positive way, in other words, you never found someone that really clicked with and became your Rebbe and all that, in a very personal kind of way, or you did. If you did, then you have an idea of what I'm talking about. Because he had this unbelievably charismatic personality we see over and over again from the memoirs of his students. And they were nuts over him. And just imagine a guy in his 20s who's a hot Rosh Hashanah. You can totally see that, you know, he's a young guy. He's got all the chevra and everything. And he could give these masterpiece shiurim of yesteryear, not the type that's used nowadays, of the chalukim, as they call it, in which you take a whole bunch of pilpils and you tie them together with one grand answer, and then you knock it down with one grand kasha, and then you rebuild it with one grand answer. I'm talking about 10 gemaras at one time, and 15 tosos and all this. And what I'm referring to is a shiur that lasts about 6 hours. You know, maybe more. We can't even conceive of that today. You know, and his guys went crazy over him. And they say, I wasn't there, but they say, that in the course of these 30 years or so, he picked up 20,000 students, which is crazy and can't be true. If you do the numbers, that means he had 500, 600, 700 new students every year, which is just not possible. But even if you tell me it's an exaggeration or you modify, let's say, for example, you tell me you had 10,000 students. Even that's not really possible if you do the numbers. But on the other hand, I just want you to know that I remember this very clearly. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, his great enemy, in one of his writings, which are voluminous, he says, I'm not impressed with your lousy 20,000 students, which means he didn't call him out and say it's a lie. So I just don't know what to do with that as a historian. I know that logistically, it's just not possible. On the other hand, they talk about this. But either way, let's say you cut it down to 2,000 students. That's still a gigantic number over 30 years, or 3,000 students, if you think about it. Now, I'm not saying he had a total keshe with each and every student, because I don't think that's possible. But he had a keshe with a lot of them. And I mean a really tight keshe. And there's story after story of people who say, oh, when I was under him, just pick whatever Rebbe you hold from and just multiply it 100 times, and then you get an idea. He was unbelievable. He was great. And we were so tight, and this and that and the other. And I picked up everything from him, and we still stay in contact, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so he's just, like, phenomenally successful. So I, to my mind, there's no question that he was clearly the most popular and the leading Rosh Yeshiva, that was Magachir, of his time. And I think, if I'm not wrong, I think of the entire early modern period. I mean, I don't know where I would go in Jewish history to hear somebody of whom a claim is made that he had tens of thousands of students. I repeat, a claim. So he might be the most popular Rosh Yeshiva of all time or something. I don't know, but certainly you don't hear about this today. That's number one. Now, in addition to that, he also got elected as the Magid, in Prague called the Darshan, which is an official position. You remember the old days. I spoke about it in these podcasts many times. The top job was divided into two. One is the Rav, and his main thing is to preside over the Bezdin and Paskin the Heavy Shilas. That's number one. Doesn't have to be a speaker or anything like that. Then the city would hire somebody, especially Prague, would hire somebody who's called the Magid or the Darshan, and his job is to give all the speeches, like they say in Baltimore, to give the Rabbi Franz speeches. Now, you know, on all different occasions. And so, hear this well. He's interacting with two tzibors. In the yeshiva, he's interacting with the Talmidim, the teenage guys, a giant population. Number two, when he gives the public speeches, he's interacting with the people of the community, which is a much larger audience. So one is the school guys, and one is the Balabatim. Clearly, to me, it's not even a question, he's the greatest orator of the 18th century, and perhaps the 17th as well. It's not a question. And a small part of his many drushes are published in the Yaros Dvash after his death. And I use them today. Many times, they're amazing. But each one is a six-hour speech. I'm not exaggerating. You think I'm exaggerating. I'm not exaggerating. Maybe even a seven-hour speech. And it's unbelievable. How do you hold an audience that long? And if you read them, and I've read them, and I've many times in my shul and elsewhere, I've given classes where we would go through his drushes in the Yaros Dvash, especially Purim time, and it always happens. The people in the audience first start yawning and say, oh no, where's this going to go? Within a minute or two, you got him, baby. And their eyes are peeled because he's just very good. And he's a master orator because he knows as he goes through page after page of his long drushes, he knows how to throw in a Gevaldig Gvar Torah and then right afterwards, a thing from the Kabbalah. And then once he got your attention hooked, then he hits you in the solar plexus with the social criticism. You guys are eating too much. They're not supporting the poor. Boys and girls are hanging around, which he's always into boys and girls hanging around with each other and things like this. There's no question. If it was up to Jonas and Abishitz, he would totally be in favor of the no women and no women's pictures in the Mishpacha. You know, he's that type. And Kayin Bekin and all these sorts of things, but I don't mean in a dumb way. You know, he talks about Rosh Hashanah. It's Rosh Hashanah at many levels, Kabbalistic, moralistic. He's just very good. What can I tell you? He's always got these highly unusual insights into Gemara, Rashi, Tosis, and this and that and the other, and Midrashim. And, you know, I won't say each and every one is amazing, but a lot of them are. And that's just my personal opinion. So how do you keep an audience for hour after hour after hour, all this sort of thing? And that's just a small fraction of what he did. So the guy was unbelievable. The bottom line goes that here you have somebody who's a two-for-one. When you get him, you get an unbelievable market share. I repeat, an unbelievable market share. And number two, you get an unbelievable speaker. That's a pretty good deal. And he liked it. I mean, he had a ball. And so all during his 20s, his 30s, and his 40s, when you got your energy, you know, he's throwing himself into these tasks. And at the same time, he is Team Abishitz. There's also Team Oppenheim. You know, the Rav has his followers, and another group has his followers. And so, like everywhere, but particularly in Prague, the city is going to be divided into a population consisting of his extreme Hasidim, but also consisting of his extreme Misnagdim, extreme opponents. This is very interesting. This is the politics of Prague in the first two-thirds of the 18th century. It's just very interesting on that level. And he is able to, by the way, I'll tell you something else, and I don't know how he did this. One of the things he did, first of all, you need money. So he had bankrollers. There's no way you can get these huge number of guys in there. Somebody's got to pay for the food, even if they eat a little bit of bread, you know, and bread and water, which is what a lot of these people ate, pasta, melech, tochal, and slept on the floor in the shuls and all that. They really did. In those days, people really cared about learning. Even if you do, I mean, still, these huge numbers eats up the money all the time. So guess what? Somehow or other, he got a law degree. Can you believe it? He got a law degree. Now, he didn't go to the university, as far as I'm aware, and it would have been found by now if he did. He didn't go to University of Prague Law School. I don't know if they had such a thing like that. But he must have klep tested. And he got a law degree. He became a lawyer of a certain type. As best as I can tell, now I only discovered this a couple of years ago. As best as I can tell, I'm going to tell you, this is my podcast. So I'm just going to tell you my guess. I think his rich relatives and friends, how are you rich in the 18th century? How are you rich? There's no stock market. How are you rich? The answer is through trade. You know, you bring in merchandise, import, export, as we call it today. So that requires a lot of paperwork and bureaucracy, does it not? And especially if it's Prague during the 18th century, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Empire, is like notorious for the red tape, the bureaucracy. That's who they were. And there are a million laws and this and that and the other, regulations, rules and regs. And so, as best as I can tell, he became like a commercial lawyer, in the sense that he handles all the legal work involved in all these mercantile transactions. So it's not a litigator in court. It's someone who handles, as I say before, all the business law and that sort of thing. And there's no question in my mind that his family and friends must have thrown all the business his way, right? And so he can make a decent living like that. But how do you have a career? That's a full-time career. I mean, how do you have a career as a lawyer in a real law firm, you know, handling real transactions, and at the same time knock out these six-hour shiurim at least once or twice a week, and then also on many, many occasions knock out these six-hour the drushes, you know, speeches, which are full of everything? The answer is he's a genius. You know, it's not you and me. It's not a typical situation at all. And the result is that he was, held in awe by his admirers, which is really why everybody got freaked out when they started accusing him of Sabbatianism. And, you know, 10 years after he was in Prague, letters came out by other Shabtai Tzvinniks that they say he's our Rebbe, our supporter. And he said these are forged letters. And, you know, all whole thing going back and forth. You know, it you can see what a shock it was. You understand? And anyway, so this is how he went on. Now, here you got somebody running a law, and you got running, what's the other thing? A magashir. And what's the other thing? Giving a speeches, darshan, a magid, of unequal power. I'm not exaggerating. I'm just giving you what I think. And, of course, he wanted the top job to be Durov also. Then he would have everything. Why would you be so ambitious? If you're that good, you're that ambitious. I mean, I can understand that totally. And he never got it. When Rav David Oppenheimer, who was 30 years older than him, died in the 1730s, they would not elect him as chief rabbi of Prague. He was interim, you understand, in the 1730s. And it must have been very frustrating for him. And I'm sure he must have been plotting with his followers sooner or later to obtain the top position, which he deserved. Listen, if you're talking about pure ability, then yes, unless you believe the people who said secretly he's a heretic, which they didn't believe. And so you see how tangled the politics is. That would bring you up to 1740 or so, when he would be in his 40s, We'd be 1694. So he'd be, I guess 46, which is not, not old. That's when all hell broke loose, because the 1740s, European politics impinged on everything. A war broke out called the War of the Austrian Succession. I'm sure you have no idea what I'm talking about. It's the wars of Frederick the Great versus Maria Theresa, of which there were two rounds. This is round one, and the Seven Years' War from 1756 is round two. So this war is a war, you can look it up if you're interested, that lasted from 1740 to 1748. It's a very famous war if you're a nut and you know all your European history details and that sort of thing. It's actually extremely interesting. Now, in this situation, to dumb it down as much as I'm capable, the king of Prussia, Frederick the Great, invaded Bohemia and captured a province there and held it called Silesia. And all hell broke loose and Europe formed into two coalitions. They fought each other because the Austrians wanted to get it back. In the course of this, Prague, from 1741 to 1745, went through a tough time. Because first they were occupied by an invading French army. And then when they were kicked out, they were occupied by Frederick the Great's invading Prussian army. You hear what I'm saying? So in 1741, 42, and into 43, and then in 1744. Now, why am I giving you all this business? First of all, the city's a war zone. That's number one. Number two, I mean, that's never good. Number two, the Austrians were the ones who originally owned Prague. And by the time it's all over in 1745, they got it back. Now, the Jews, when they were living under the Jewish community, when they were living under French occupation and Prussian occupation, they just tried to get along. So whoever's in charge, that's who you do business with. What am I supposed to do? I'm a civilian. I'm a poor Jew. Well, the Austrians were beyond PO. They were really angry at anybody who would be traitorous enough to cooperate with the enemy. And the Empress Maria Theresa of Austria, who was the ruler, was extremely anti-Semitic even before this. And so by the time it's over, the Jews were kicked out of Prague. It's the last great expulsion of the Middle Ages in 1745. And Prague and Bohemia, by the way. And so it was a tough business. In the middle of all this, while Prague was occupied by the French army, it's an Abschutz, who seems to have given up on ever getting the position of chief rabbi of Prague as long as his enemies were such a strong force. Like the morale I told you last week. You have your team, but they're a big team against you. And so he said it's never going to happen. And so he decided to seek his fortune elsewhere. Meaning, if my own city, which he loved, and it was up to him, he would stay there. And like I told you before, Prague had all the yeshivas, and Prague had all the big community, and the alumnus, and all the great opportunities. And it's a pretty city anyway. It's a nice city. I was just there. But he said, it's just not going to happen. And so what else is out there? And so the city of Metz, the Jewish community of Metz, which is the other side, which is in France. Remember, the city was occupied by the French army. So they elected him as the Rav there, and he decided to take it. And so the French garrison let him through with a safe conduct to travel in the middle of the war through the French territory to become the rabbi of Metz. Of course, from the Austrian point of view, it means he cooperated with the enemy and his Chayav Misa. You know what I'm saying? And he was declared an enemy of the state by the Empress Maria Theresa and his Chayav Misa if he ever steps foot in Austrian territory. Woo! His enemies, well, it depends how you look at it. You could say, what a coward. He abandoned his community in the middle of the siege. Alternatively, you can say he did like Yochanan Zakkai. When he went to Metz, he worked Yom Belayla, he really did, to try to rescue as much as possible the Jewish community of Prague, get them money, organize an international lobbying effort, I kid you not, to get the Austrian government to change its mind and revoke the expulsion, which eventually it sort of did because of the intervention of the English and the Dutch and others. And so it's an extremely complicated and fascinating story. I told you, to do this right, I need 5 hours, just like one of his speeches. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that. I think you're getting a little bit of an idea from the little, I'm just scratching the surface. Well, I'm telling you what a complex and unusual individual this was. Already, when he was in Metz, he's already... Now, by the way, I left out one thing, which I shouldn't have left out. I'm just blabbing over here. In addition to him having a home run in the Gemara and a home run in the Drushes and all the rest of it, a home run in the Kabbalah. He was a big Mekubal. Everybody knew that he's he knows the Arizal stuff, unbelievable. Matter of fact, his student, who was a real firm guy, wrote in the Hesped of him, I'm talking about Zarach Eidlitz, in the Or HaSham, I have the Sefer. He said, you didn't know my Rebbe, Yonatan Abishitz. In Nigla, he was like the Rambam. And in Nistar, he was like the Rizal. Those are big statements, right? Even coming from a student. He was a giant in the Kabbalah, which is precisely why people started going to him and getting kamiyas. Because, you know, if you're sick or something like that, miscarriages, you write a kamiya with the right shemos, with the right formulas, letter, you know, Hebrew letters in certain ways, it's supposed to bring refu and atzlocha and all the other sorts of things like that, if you're into that. And there are books, by the way, on how to write kamiyas, which were not unpopular in the 16th, 1700s. I have myself a very famous collection, which is the most famous of them all, and it's called... It's called Sharshe Hashemus from Moshe Zakuto from Italy. And it's got all the different permutations and ways of writing it. In fact, one of the big art, well, you'll see in a second, it was in Metz that people started to say, the kamiyas he gives really say Shabtai Tzvinin in some coded fashion. It doesn't say it openly, but if you use some kind of a code, you can see Shabtai Tzvi and things like this. Of course, he says not true, and you're not supposed to open them anyway. And for 10 years or so, he was a rabbi in Metz. He said, listen, it's a nice community. It's a rich community. It ain't Prague. The Jewish community was a fraction of the size of Prague, and the yeshiva he had there was nowhere like Prague. It's like saying you're moving from Lakewood, and you're going to, I don't know, you know, some smaller town in the U.S. It's nice. It's very nice, and so on and so forth. It ain't Lakewood, you know. That's that kind of way of talking. And, you know, he really pined for the old place, but he can't go back because he's Chayav Misa. I told you before, he's not going back. Here, I'll tell you a really cute story. Other communities wanted him, and they offered him double salary and better terms for a bigger yeshiva. I'm thinking specifically of Firth, which was near Nuremberg. That's the important big yeshiva center in South Germany once upon a time, in Bavaria. There's a three volumes by Rabbi Hamburger, all about the history of the yeshiva in Firth over many centuries. And they wrote to him and offered him the moon, and he accepted, but he had already signed the contract with Metz, which committed him to staying for 12 years, or else he pays a $6,000 fine. Well, not $6,000, but 6,000 gulden. And he just couldn't pay, so he was stuck in Metz. So, you know, it was really funny in that way. He writes back to them, he was afraid to tell them, and it's a constant story. This was the rabbinical politics of the old year. You signed a contract for 3 years, and then you signed a contract for 12 years, and then the rest is for life or something like that. But you see, he just wasn't happy there. When the 12 years were up or so, people heard about him, and the communities offered him to get the job. Not Prague, even though he would love for that. He's Chayav Misa in Prague. So he can't go to the Austrian Empire. He can't do it. And so he took Hamburg, or what they call the three communities at that time, Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek, three places which are all part of the big city of Hamburg today, but at that time were three different jurisdictions, and they shared one rabbin and one beis din. In North Germany, you know, on the Baltic or whatever, or near the Baltic, it's on the Atlantic side, a big a port city, and it's a chashuva community, you know, no question about it. These are everything I'm mentioning are the important, well-to-do kehillas of yesterday that could pay a decent salary, and also support a yeshiva. Prague, Metz, Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek, Firth, you know, Frankfurt, these are the places. And that's where he spent the rest of his life just about. This happened in 1750-51. When he came there, he said, this is my last stop. Prague is not going to work out, but I hope it'll work out over here. Eva la Moshe b'lo, you know, he has a play on words. Eva la Moshe b'lo, you say he desired to dwell there. Alavav hey is equal to Ahu, Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek. And he's into all the word plays and things like that. And he figured he'll do the same thing. He'll give his amazing shiurim, so he'll build a yeshiva there. They had money. He'll give his drushes. And by this time, also, he's a big posek and all the rest of it. No question about that. And even though I didn't talk about Pesach Halacha before, but he was. And the Kabbalah stuff, whatever. And this is where it happened, that because Yaakov Emden lived in the city. In Altona, and he hated him, and then not Stammen de Velterine. You know, this is something I don't want to get into today because I'm already at 30 some minutes, and that will take me another 3.5 hours. But let's put it this way. He made a big mistake moving to a town where one of his big enemies was located, because they immediately looked for things he was doing wrong. And even though, I said this before, Rabbi Yochanan says, he was a good speaker, although later he denied that, and his first speech was blasting the community for having, what was it, figurines, you know, like we say, porcelain furniture, you know, porcelain little statues. It's like a Avodah Zarah. And they all broke the statues. He said, you know, he was an incredible orator. You know, people spend money. After he heard that Musar Shmuz, they went home and broke all their furniture. It was that type. And I also remember that the first Shabbos, he had such a big reputation as a Mekubal that everybody, when they walked by to say good Shabbos to the new rabbi, they put their hat over their forehead so you can't see what's the forehead. Because if he's a real Arizal type guy, he can read what you're thinking. Who wants that? You know, this is the kind of reputation he had. However, right then, this is 1751, hit the end, the name should suffice, because they said they discovered Kamias that he wrote that are clearly Shabtai Tzvi. All hell broke loose. And a lot of big rabbis said he's a Shabtai Tzvi, but a follower. A lot of others didn't. He had hundreds of rabbis on his side. They had lots of rabbis on their side. And that's why the two sides are pretty even. And for the rest of the 1750s, for the next several years, this great controversy raged. But I want to give you the plain, simple facts in the few minutes I have left over. People like Rabbi Yaakov Emden and the Pnei Yeshua elders, they told the community, the rabbi you hired is a heretic. Therefore, you should fire him. Okay, let's be clear about that. That's what they demanded. They had no proof, but they said they had circumstantial proof. And you can fire him. And the circumstantial proof consists of the Kamias. And you can look, they're online, I bet. You know, there's nothing secret about what I'm talking about. There are pictures of them, and you can, you know, do your own atbash and all that sort of thing and see if it comes out, whether you agree with it or not. And, you know, he said it means something else, obviously. And the community, when approached by these rabbis, said, get out of here. We're not listening. You guys are nuts. He's a big Talmud Chacham, and he's a firm guy. Get off our backs. They said, no, you must fire him. He said, we were not going to fire him. The reason we're not going to fire him is we think you're wrong. You're liars. You hate him. And you're Lashon Harniks and all that. They said, no, we're not Lashon Harniks. We're trying to stamp out Shabtai Tzvi. They said, so the community said, so are we, but he's not Shabtai Tzvi. And so this was the long and the short of it. He had to stand for election several times, and he won overwhelmingly each time. So the public out there, the broad public, did not buy into this. And his own Kehillah did not buy into this. Now, there were a few Yechidim that did, but the masses were convinced that everything that said about him is not true. That's why the Frum world today doesn't hold of it. Nothing was ever proved. And if I make a statement about you and I don't back it up in a legal way, then you can't, then I give no nemunas to it. It's more complicated than I'm saying. There's no question about that. But I'm giving you the stark basic facts. And so for the rest of his life, from 1751 till he died in 1764, at the age of 70, he was the Rav in this city. And there was nothing any of his enemies could do about it. They could only say, you got the wrong guy, he's a communist, he's a secret spy, this and that and the other. And it is true that he had a son, he had several children. One of the sons did become a big Shabtai Tzvi follower. He was a weirdo and a Sybarite and all this, no question about it. And that just fed fuel to the fire. But just take it from me, because I know this better than most people. You're going to find as many proofs on this side, as proofs on that side. There are letters from his students in Hamburg. Like somebody wrote to the Nodav Yehuda, and he says, oh, my son went to the yeshiva, it's all kfira. It's all kfira. On the other hand, I can show you letters from the Rav and for some of the firmest rabbis. Oh, I had this chus to learn in that yeshiva in Hamburg under Yonatan Neimschitz, and all he heard was Kedusha Tahira, you know. So what are you supposed to do with all this? You see, the public likes the controversy. The fact that he had so many people against him, even though he had a majority for him, obviously hurt. And his enemies tried to get him in trouble with the Erkos, you know, with the Geisha courts. But that backfired because the truth of the matter is, and I don't even have time to speak about it today, with his law degree and his context, he had much better context in relation with the Goyim than any other rabbi in the 18th century. He knew the Jesuits in Prague and was actually able to persuade them to allow him to print a copy of the Gemara, because at that time they're burning all the Gemaras, provided that he would censor it from things that are not offensive to Christianity. But when he did that, then Yaakov and the other says, see, he's cooperating with the Catholics. He said, no, I'm not cooperating with Catholics. I'm just trying to get a Gemara printed because we don't have any books. How are we going to be able to run a yeshiva? And so on and so on and so forth. But the King of Denmark and all these other people backed him and not his enemies. Every time they tried to take it, his enemies tried to take it to the Vlad Arba Rotzes, the leading rabbis and leaders in Poland, which still had power. Well, guess what? The Vlad Arba and Jakub Endin wrote a letter to them, I forget what it's called, Safkus or something like that, in which he called him every name in the book. And even, this is going to drive you crazy, they accused him of Gila Rai Shvicha de Mordazor, and that's not an exaggeration. They say he's Mizana with his own daughter. I mean, they went, you know, off the wall. And the Vlad Arba Rotzes said like this, you guys are nuts. He's a Kaddish Vatar, and you really lost your minds. And so they backed him. So everybody they turned to ended up backing the Sinaitis. They wrote to the Sephardim. The Sephardim said, we don't see nothing wrong with him. He's okay. And they wrote to Eretz Yisrael. Same thing. So it was like very frustrating for the opponents. You understand? But even with all those confirmations, it embittered his life. And what's really interesting is in the last couple of years, when he hit his late 60s, he wanted to give up the job and just move back to Prague and be a private citizen. Ha ha, as if something like this was ever possible. At that time, the rabbi in Prague was a noted Behuda, in the 1760s, who already stood in tight with the Austrian government. Maria Theresa was still the empress, and he was in tight with her because he strongly supported the Austrian army during the next wars, the Seven Years' War. And so she liked him. She didn't like any Jew, but if you had to have a rabbi, she'd rather have him. And he wrote her a famous letter, which is very controversial, in which he said, it's him or me. If Abishus comes here, he's a Shabtai Tzvinik, he'll mess up my community, he'll cause machlokas Jain Kamo, my position will be untenable, and if he comes, I leave. Whereupon she said, he's not coming, you know. So he wasn't able to return to his beloved city, spent the last years of his life, and he died in Hamburg. Now, I've only scratched the surface, I've gone longer than usual. I think you have an impression of what I talked about that only scratched the surface. But here's somebody that is so unusual because it's A-plus in many categories. You find some people are good rabbis, but they're not good speakers. Or they're good Rosh Hashivas, but not good Mekubalim. Here's somebody hit A-plus in every direction. He, as you know, he published two, as you know, maybe you don't know, he published two famous Sfarim, The Crazy Place on the Yerodea, which is still used, and the Urim Batumim. The Ketzos wrote a thing to slug up the Urim Batumim. You know, that's what the Ketzos is. But these are two huge areas. Somebody once wrote, I don't know if it's true, and it's a good story. Why did he write a halacha? Because here's how the story goes. I told you the story when it says Pnei Yeshua. The Pnei Yeshua wrote on Lomdus, and Yonatan Abishus wrote on halacha. Pnei Yeshua said, everybody thinks I know halacha, but I know Lomdus. I'll prove I'll write the Pnei Yeshua. And Yonatan Abishus said, everybody thinks I know Pilpul, but I don't know halacha lamaisa. I'll write the crazy place in the Urim Batumim. What can I tell you? They don't tell you these legends about you and me. But he was a figure of controversy because he stood out. Who has a law degree? You know, in one of his speeches, he says, you don't really understand. It's in the Yaros Rosh. You don't understand Chosha Mishpat until you understand the Buris Corpus Civilis, until you understand the Holy Roman Empire, German Imperial system of law, to compare different law systems. What God writes like this? You know, it's extremely unusual. So the final verdict on Yonatan Abishus that everybody will agree to is, highly unusual. Besides that, everybody's the controversies still rage on today. And as I said before, I only told you a percent of a percent. But beyond that, I'm not getting into that today. And with that, I wish you a good week.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.